On this Saturday night, death of Fidel Castro, the passing of a dictator whose half-century rule over Cuba brought the world to the brink of nuclear war and forced generations of Cubans to flee to America's shores. Celebration and reflection, the eruption of joy by Cuban Americans in the streets of Miami, and the starkly different reactions from the president and the president-elect. Storms of trouble, the severe weather that could mean a treacherous trip for some of the millions heading home after the long holiday weekend. And the digital front line, how Google has joined the fight against ISIS, using their latest technology as a weapon. Nightly news begins right now.
From NBC News World Headquarters in New York, this is NBC Nightly News with Lester Holt.
Good evening. Fidel Castro, the communist revolutionary who turned a small Caribbean island into an American foreign policy obsession, is being remembered as both a repressive tyrant and a savior of his people tonight. The very contradiction that defined his almost 50 years of rule. In Havana, where a nine-day period of mourning is underway, people openly wept in the streets after news broke of his death overnight. While in this country, Cuban exiles and their descendants celebrated the news in the streets of Miami's Little Havana. Though he relinquished power a decade ago, Fidel Castro goes to his grave as a dynamic figure of the Cold War, who once nearly nudged the U.S. and Russia into a nuclear war. Our team is reporting from around the region. We begin tonight with NBC's chief foreign affairs correspondent, Andrea Mitchell. Andrea?
Good evening, Lester. Here at Miami Airport, Cuban Americans are lined up to go to Cuba or to greet relatives visiting from the island. No place in America has been as affected by Fidel Castro's nearly 50-year reign as South Florida, where he is reviled by many who were exiled during his reign, even as in his heyday he was admired by many around the world. To his followers, he was Comandante, or just Fidel. To his enemies, a feared dictator, one of the world's last communists. The legendary firebrand began life simply, the illegitimate son of a middle-class landowner. A student radical, he graduated with both a law degree and a doctorate, tried running for the National Assembly in 1952, until Cuban strongman Batista seized power and canceled the elections. In 1953, Castro led a rebel group against Batista's military barracks and failed. Castro ended up in jail for 2 years, until an amnesty, when he went into exile. In Mexico, Castro regrouped with his brother Raul and fellow revolutionary Ernesto Che Guevara. On New Year's Day, 1959, they toppled Batista and marched into Havana. At first, the young leader promised democracy, telling the U.S. he was not a communist. Meet the press in April 1959.
I am not communist. I am not agree with communists.
But almost from the start, Castro confiscated the property of the wealthy, silenced newspapers, nationalized U.S. oil refineries, and signed a pact with the Soviet Union. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy ordered the CIA to invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, using a force of anti-Castro exiles.
At 3:45 p.m., Wednesday, April 19, resistance ends.
The resulting debacle only helped Castro consolidate power. By then a declared socialist, he dramatically improved health care and literacy, but also accepted Soviet missiles, bringing the superpowers to the brink of nuclear war.
Requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Until JFK's hard line and back-channel diplomacy got the Russians to pull back. For 25 years, Moscow helped Castro arm communist insurgents throughout Latin America.
Viva la Revolución Sandinista!
But with the end of the Soviet Union, Cuba's economy imploded. On makeshift boats, thousands of Cubans fled the increasingly repressive regime. In 1999, a custody battle over 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez became the symbol of America's struggle with Fidel Castro. In the summer of 2006, after undergoing intestinal surgery, Fidel Castro temporarily turned over power to his brother Raul. 2 years later, he officially stepped down and was succeeded by his brother. Fidel spent his later years writing columns about his life experiences, emerging publicly for Pope Benedict's visit to Havana in 2012, and for Vladimir Putin and China's President Xi in 2014. This past March, Fidel was nowhere to be seen during President Obama's historic meeting in Cuba with Raul Castro. Days later, Fidel wrote an editorial criticizing the U.S. and Obama, saying, "We do not need the empire to give us anything." Fidel Castro never tolerated free elections or dissent, but gave his people better health care and education. Still, his real legacy may be holding power for nearly half a century, longer than any other modern leader. I first went to Cuba in 1999 to cover the anti-U.S. protests for NBC News during the fight over Elian Gonzalez, the custody fight over that six-year-old boy. In my first interview then with Fidel Castro, and over the years in many interviews, he was argumentative. He would talk all night. He would debate. He was on the Internet, even though his people could not, for the most part, be on the Internet. He followed our newscasts. He told me what he didn't like, and we had a lot of arguments over politics, which, in fact, continued for many years. His final newspaper column was against the U.S. election only 2 weeks ago. Lester?
Andrea Mitchell tonight. Andrea, thank you. And back in the U.S., the news of Fidel Castro's death was largely met with celebration. It was a festival-like atmosphere in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood, with an eruption of joy pouring into the streets overnight. Kerry Sanders has been there for all of it.
Celebrations, Cuban style.
Castro's died. Castro's died. It's important to us. It's an opportunity to be free.
One in three people in Greater Miami is Cuban American, a diaspora of more than a million people who waited 57 years for Fidel Castro's death.
I would call him a dictator, a thug, a murderer. He is our version of Hitler.
The party began in the early morning hours on Little Havana's famed Calle Ocho. Even Miami's mayor, born in Cuba himself, showed up.
They just came because they want to celebrate not the death of a human being, but the death of a dictator.
Zully Pardo fled Cuba in 1961. She was 5 years old. Her father and mother died in the United States in exile.
Those are tears of
joy and sadness at the same time.
While Cubans continue to escape the communist island, more than 46,000 coming to the United States in just the last 12 months, it is the oldest Cuban Americans who best remember what they lost when Fidel Castro rose to power. Dr. Blanca Garcia's father lost his farm and his future.
They took everything. I am a farmer girl, and they took everything from my father.
The question now, what happens next?
Hopefully we will have a future democracy in Cuba, and I'll be able to go back and visit the land of my birth.
Tonight, Calle Ocho here in Little Havana is filled with thousands of people. This will be a party that will go on for hours. Most people here found out about Fidel Castro's death on social media. But in a nod to the old school, the Miami Herald ran a special edition this afternoon, Castro Dead. Lester?
Quite a scene there. Kerry, thank you. And Castro's death brought to the forefront once again the complicated relationship the U.S. has with Cuba. President Obama made the dramatic first step to normalize relations with the communist island, but President-elect Trump seems to have a much different view. Ron Allen has more now from the White House.
Today, vastly different responses from the president and president-elect. In a statement, Mr. Obama extending a hand of friendship to Cuba, avoiding any mention of Castro's human rights abuses, and looking forward, reflecting his dramatic policy shift 2 years ago to normalize relations with Cuba.
This is a new day. Es un nuevo día between our two countries.
Mr. Obama today even offering condolences to Castro's family. While from President-elect Trump, first a blunt tweet, Fidel Castro is dead. Then a statement recalling a brutal dictator with a legacy of firing squads, theft, unimaginable suffering. On the campaign trail,
we will cancel Obama's one-sided Cuban deal.
Mr. Trump threatened to undo Mr. Obama's executive orders and regulatory changes that now allow more travel and trade between Cuba and America. Steps taken by the Obama administration as Congress refuses to lift a 50-year embargo on Cuba. Top Republicans calling on Mr. Trump, who today did not repeat his vow to reverse Mr. Obama's policies, to take a hard line because the Castro family remains in charge.
Don't expect Fidel's death to usher this new chapter, a happy chapter of freedom.
Fidel Castro.
Around the world, the communist revolutionary's allies also weighing in on his death. Vladimir Putin calling Castro a true and reliable friend of Russia. Syria's Assad praising Castro for standing up to the most ferocious of sanctions witnessed in our modern world.
Here in Washington, Congress has no intention of lifting those sanctions, while the Obama administration in its final weeks continues trying to deepen America's new relationships with Cuba. With Fidel Castro's death, Cuba suddenly much higher on President-elect Trump's agenda. Lester?
Ron Allen at the White House for us. Thank you, Ron. Stay with NBC News and MSNBC for our continuing coverage of the death of Fidel Castro. Our team will be on the ground in Cuba starting tomorrow morning and through the week, leading to the funeral next weekend. If you thought the presidential election was behind us, word came today from the Hillary Clinton campaign that it will back the statewide election recount effort put on by third-party candidate Jill Stein in three key battleground states. Kristen Welker joins me now to explain more about this. Kristen.
Lester, good evening. This all started when a group of computer scientists, including a voting rights lawyer, said they found voting irregularities in three states. And that is what is prompting this. In those three states, Donald Trump has a combined margin of victory of about 100,000 votes. Now, today on Medium, Secretary Clinton's lawyer posted that the campaign has received hundreds of messages, emails, and calls urging us to do something, anything, to investigate claims that the election results were hacked and altered in a way to disadvantage Secretary Clinton. Clinton's campaign lawyer also stressed they have not found any evidence of hacking, but some Democrats are skeptical after U.S. officials said they uncovered evidence of Russians hacking Democratic emails during the campaign. Meanwhile, President-elect Donald Trump, vacationing here in Palm Beach, called the recount ridiculous and a scam, noting that Secretary Clinton had conceded on election night. You may recall that in the weeks leading up to the election, it was Donald Trump who said the entire system is rigged. That is why this is getting so much attention and one of the reasons why Democrats are so frustrated, because right now Secretary Clinton leads Donald Trump by more than 2 million votes in the popular vote, Lester.
All right. Kristen Welker, thanks very much. And a quick programming note, much more on that recount, plus a look at the Trump promises tomorrow on Meet the Press. The Army Corps of Engineers ordered activists at the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline to shut down one of their camps. Increased violence between protesters and police, combined with harsh winter conditions, mean the area will now be closed, according to the federal agency. In a statement, a tribal chairman expressed disappointment but insisted, quote, "Our resolve to protect our water is stronger than ever." The long holiday weekend comes to a close tomorrow. For many Americans, that means it's time to start packing for the drive or flight home. Dylan Dreyer has us covered on travel conditions across the country and the potential trouble spots. Dylan?
We are keeping an eye on some spots across the country for travelers on Sunday. We have a storm system that's going to make its way onto the West Coast. We're looking at heavier rain up and down the coast. That stretches from Seattle down to L.A., but also some snow through the mountains. So mountain passes could be a little bit tricky, too. We have a cold front that's going to bring some heavier downpours and gusty winds from Minneapolis over into St. Louis. Notice it's not until really late in the day on Sunday. So hopefully if you're traveling early, you shouldn't have too much trouble. But that will be an area through the Midwest we're watching Sunday, and it's really out through the Rockies and extending over into Salt Lake City, where we could see some minor delays with the snow coming down. Minneapolis, we could see some delays later in the afternoon if that front moves in a little bit sooner. And also L.A., we could see some isolated delays, mostly because of the occasional showers and the gusty winds that we're expecting. If you're driving, we could be slow going I-80, also I-70 and I-15 up in the Pacific Northwest as that storm system continues to make its way onshore.
All right, Dylan Dreyer, thank you. And still ahead tonight, Google versus ISIS, how the tech giant is helping in the war against terror. Plus, a movement that's catching on this holiday season, temporary workers living just steps from where they work in the comfort of their campers. From San Bernardino to Orlando, recent terror attacks have raised concerns about Americans being radicalized, not in war zones, but online. One tech giant gave us an exclusive look at how they're responding. NBC's Ronan Farrow has our report.
This may not look like the latest front in the fight against terrorism, but here at Google, researchers believe they could be on to a new way to confront ISIS.
The Islamic State has heralded a new era in online extremism.
Yasmin Green is the head of research and development at Jigsaw, Google's technology incubator for geopolitical problems. Its latest challenge? Reaching a new generation of bedroom radicals, people drawn into violent extremism online. Like many of the estimated 30,000 foreigners who have joined ISIS from around the world.
We believed that there was an opportunity to use the internet to get to those potential recruits before ISIS.
They call it redirect.
We've all had the experience of searching for something like a pair of sneakers and then finding an ad for those sneakers pop up later. And we have used that same principle instead to find potential consumers of ISIS's messages online.
If I'm a young person out there somewhere, maybe sympathetic to joining ISIS, what's the process I go through?
So you would likely search, for example, for a term like, let's take martyrdom for Allah. You would enter that. We would show you an ad that would be directly relevant to your search. You'd click on the ad and you'd be taken to, for example, a video like this.
Videos of imams and religious scholars, potentially credible to ISIS sympathizers, but preaching against ISIS, not supporting it.
Anything's worth trying, isn't it? But at least make it harder. Make it harder for them to steal our children.
Sally Evans' son Thomas grew up in a London suburb.
He was just a normal little boy. It was happening upstairs in our bedroom. He was on his computer.
Like many online recruits, he drifted away from family and friends, eventually joining the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. He was killed in this terrorist attack in Africa. The group used video of his death as propaganda.
No mother should have to see that. That was awful. It was just here in the final moments. As a mum, and there was nothing I could do.
I could have done that. I could have done worse.
Sohail Ahmed also fell into radicalism online.
People need to know that anyone can become radicalized.
He was considering a bomb attack in London, but pulled back.
What led me away from radicalism was kind of listening to more relatively moderate scholars and imams.
He was not a part of Redirect, but thinks it could discourage others. It appears some may be listening. In an 8-week pilot program, Jigsaw says Redirect reached 300,000 people who watched 500,000 minutes of video, all of it aimed at undermining ISIS. Ronan Farrow, NBC News, London.
We are back in a moment with Black Friday numbers, record-breaking online spending in the U.S., and a make-or-break day for many brick-and-mortar retailers. We're back with new numbers out tonight on the Black Friday shopping blitz. Americans spent a record amount scooping up sales online yesterday. But as Jolene Kent explains, it's still a make-or-break weekend for those brick-and-mortar stores.
Thanksgiving discounts driving huge numbers of shoppers to open their wallets this holiday weekend.
Pretty sure I saved about $500.
You get out early, you get the best deals.
Online, Americans shelled out a record $3.34 billion on Black Friday, up more than 11% from last year. $1.2 billion worth of merchandise purchaced on mobile devices.
Wall-to-wall traffic, and you see in every store window that there's a great sale taking place. I think that that can only mean that the economy is headed in a better direction.
But those deals did not necessarily mean more people heading to stores. Retail data firm ShopperTrack says visits to brick-and-mortar retailers were down 1% from last year. Today, shoppers skipped big-box stores in favor of the little guy for Small Business Saturday.
You don't want to see any of these boutique stores. Go, you want them to stick around. It gives the neighborhood personality.
The deals won't stop this weekend as consumers turn their attention to Cyber Monday, set to be the biggest online shopping day in history.
You're able to, you know, get something, a brand that's 40% off that normally you can't.
E-tailers like Amazon hawking at least 75,000 different deep discounts. Analysts forecast shoppers will dole out $3 billion on Monday, with brands leveraging this weekend's in-store traffic to drive online spending.
So you're going to see more retailers putting together strategies that kind of converge both the online shopping and the physical store shopping.
Retailers covering all their bases, betting on a big holiday bump. Jolene Kent, NBC News.
When we come back, workers on wheels, the mobile force following those seasonal jobs. Finally tonight, this holiday season, with so many Americans shopping during the next month, temporary workers are in high demand. A new migrant workforce is filling many of those jobs. Janet Shamlian has more on the group commonly called work campers.
When Dollywood turns on 4 million lights for the holidays, it's transformative for more than the guests.
I'm so glad y'all are here.
Betty Gill, a former bank vice president, runs a cash register at the theme park.
Sign that for me, please.
You got pork tenderloin and smoked turkey. Hey, we'll get you fixed up.
Her husband, Mike, a retired executive, is boss of the buffet.
And we got the gravy that goes on top of it.
After their six-hour shift, they head home. A 38-foot RV, currently parked in the shadow of the Smoky Mountains.
I've got gypsy in my blood, and Mike does too.
These modern-day nomads are mostly baby boomers who've had it with the 9-to-5, trading lucrative careers for low-paying seasonal jobs and a lifestyle change.
We were both in corporate, 60 to 80 hours a week. When we leave Dollywood and we flip the last burger or whatever, they close it up.
Dozens of companies are embracing these work campers. Not all semi-retire.
It's all good.
So far, we've been up the East Coast, from Florida up to Maine and back.
Now in Texas, the Leonard family is work camping until Christmas. David makes $11.25 an hour at an Amazon warehouse, while Danielle blogs about frugal living and homeschools their children.
How long do you think you'll keep doing it?
As long as we can. As long as life lets us.
At Dollywood, the Gills' part-time jobs end next month. Their income, enough to make their next stop, time off in Florida.
We're living on 20%. And we haven't starved yet. We haven't gone to bed hungry.
A craving for something different as work campers trade money for memories. Janet Shamley in NBC News, Pigeon Forge, Tennessee.
That will do it for us on this Saturday night. I'm Lester Holt. For all of us at NBC News, thank you for watching and good night.